I had written a little self-published memoir that I gave to somebody the other day and asked me to inscribe it. So I wrote down to so-and-so, best wishes, Don Swain. He looked at it and he said, that's the best you could think of for an inscription.
I find myself absolutely stumped by inscriptions. I never know what to say. I always assume I'm supposed to say something clever, particularly if it's a funny book, I don't know what it is. I wouldn't want to say it all again, you know. Wouldn't want to say it more than once if you did say it. So that's what I say. Best wishes. That's about as clever as I get.
I don't think that's bad. What irks me, though, is if I do an interview with an author whose book I like and I want to save it and I want it inscribed, what irritates me is when the author will write, thanks for a good interview.
Right.
I had a really fine writer in the other day named William Kennedy.
The Albany guy, you mean?
Yes, from Albany. And I had sought out his first book. I was lucky I found it. Paid more than I should have for it. But the condition of the book was more than made up by his inscription, which was, it said, to Don Swain, who found this relic of my past in the Gotham bookmarked. May you enjoy Bailey's Odyssey. Sincerely, William Kennedy. He said all on the whole title page.
Right.
Very, very nice. I just thought that was very clever.
Yeah.
Because most of us aren't very clever about things like that. You just want to get it over with.
Well, also, you know, if you do a bunch of them or something, you think, my God, I can't. Probably not going to think of a new joke for each one of these things. Just don't have that in me. And you really want to say the same joke I just say, really, best wishes. So, I mean, that's a big thing for me. I mean, I prefer to sign my name, but
that's right. Besides, you're paid to write, not paid to write inscriptions.
No, exactly. Yeah.
Well, I going through the book here, I thought this is kind of a hard one to figure out what to talk about exactly. But I figured that you and I would have something to say. So, because this is something. Different. I think most people associate you with kind of light, breezy commentaries on American life as well as fine dining or not so fine dining. And this is kind of a departure from what you're known for, isn't it, right?
Well, it is as far as book publishing in a way, although the first book I did was about the integration of the University of Georgia, which was limited in laughs, I think. I really started the, particularly writing about eating, as a kind of a comic relief in a series of pieces that were more serious than funny. And the ones I particularly liked tended to be about killings, and that's how this came about. So in a way, it's not a departure for me in the sense that these are pieces I've done over 15 years, but certainly it's from the books I've published in the last five or six books, it is a departure, you know.
You don't have any preoccupation with killing, do you?
No. You mean, am I dangerous? I don't think so. I think reporters love murders in general. I think most reporters are court buffs, and most of them like murders partly from the drama, the fact that the story has some kind of structure ready-made. Also the fact often that the leading character in the story is beyond the libel laws somewhere in heaven. Or somewhere. And I've always been interested in it. But these pieces are not necessarily about the killing itself. There is some kind of killing in every one of them, but they're short on violence, at least from what you'd expect from a book of that name. And I simply found it the best way to be there in a lot of cases. If this series was really an attempt to write about the country without emphasizing government and politics. And that often meant being there during a controversy of some sort or when the community was taking sides in some way. Sometimes it's some kind of event, like a catfish festival or something. But I think most often, when I was satisfied with it, simply a murder or a killing of some sort, partly because people find that an important enough event to draw some shades back that otherwise might not be drawn back. And partly it was a way of dealing with people one at a time in their lives, more than their deaths, without making somebody into a typical farmer or the typical working man or something like that?
Well, outside of the individual deaths in each of the articles contained in your book, Killings, is there any common thread that runs through the book?
I don't think so. I mean, I should be able to think of not only a common thread, but a grand common thread on some sort of that would give all these things some great meaning. I think it's certainly not a thread about violence in the United States, except, of course, to the extent that it would be hard for a reporter in most countries to use killings as a way of being there. That is, that they're infrequent if you were doing, instead of U.S. journal, if you were doing Danish journal or British journal, you might not be able casually to pick a murder. There aren't that many compared to what we have here. And I think it's to some extent, it's more about sudden death, murder, killings of people who aren't ordinarily the sort of people whose lives might be expected to take that turn. That is, and it's certainly not a demographically balanced book. That is, there aren't any stories about somebody going in to rob a convenience store and killing the clerk because he got impatient. But those sorts of stories seem to me to be what you'd expect, and they're now almost mannered. There's almost no way to write about them without writing about, now we're going to trace the life of two people who came together at the 7-Eleven late one rainy Wednesday night. I do think that in the last 15 or 20 years particularly, the possibility of murder, violence, sudden death is more present in the lives of people who ordinarily wouldn't think of themselves as being in that sort of situation. This story there about the boy in Savannah who was killed at the end, there's somebody, he was from a very respectable family, and one of the friends of his family at the end said, it's only been recently that we had to worry about our kids knowing people like that. Not simply getting shot by them, but knowing them. And I think the fact that this really runs through the society is more true now than it used to be some years ago when lines were a little more rigid and there was an underworld and something that wasn't an underworld.
Well, you may have just answered this question, or maybe I can ask you for some more elaboration, but after putting all of these articles together in a single book, have you drawn any conclusions about the state of violence in America?
Well, I mean, it's statistically a violent place. There's no question about that. It's not unusual to read in the paper that Houston had more murders than Great Britain last year, or Detroit had more murders than France, or something like that. I think it differs from part of the country to part of the country. I was doing a piece once in West Virginia about a dispute over some textbooks. And like a lot of disputes in that part of West Virginia, there was a constant talk of the possibility of violence, that the miners might go out. I suppose the miners go out at practically any excuse, which I think I would too if I were a miner, and that there would be some kind of violence, and even a very specific notion of what it was. Hit on the head with a number 4 coal shovel is what everybody always said, which is kind of terrifying because it gives you the idea that they tried a number 2 first and a number 6 and finally decided the best thing to hit somebody on the head with was a number 4. It has a kind of a terrifying specificity to it. And, of course, in West Virginia and places like that, the way that working people have gotten whatever they've gotten is through solidarity, through the assumption that they would act as a group, and that those who ruined everything by not acting with the group might be hit on the head with a number 4 coal shovel. I got to New York, and somebody at the airport, a taxi driver, said, "You want to ride to Manhattan?" And I said, "Well, there's a line out there." And he tried to get me to go with him because he had an air-conditioned cabin. I went to the head of the line. I said, you know, this guy is busting the queue there. He said, yeah, I know. Their hack bureau is supposed to take care of that, and they don't. Well, in West Virginia, it's obvious to me that the man would be dealt with, probably with a number four coal shovel or a gun. On the other hand, a New York taxi driver might shoot you if you asked for change for a quarter and got him right at the end of his rope. That it is, West Virginia is not more violent than New York necessarily, but that it varies from different parts of the country to different parts of the country. Yeah. On the other hand, I think you really, obviously now, particularly with the spread of guns, you obviously have more of a chance of getting killed anywhere than you used to, just with simple statistics.
Are you familiar with the work of Marvin Harris,
the anthropologist, yeah, sociologist, yeah.
University of Florida, I believe.
Right.
About 2 years ago, maybe a year ago, he came out with a book, the title which escapes me, but they sent me a copy. And he had done a lot of statistical analysis of crime figures, and he reached this conclusion that if you were to eliminate the crimes committed by blacks and Puerto Ricans or Hispanics, the American crime rate would be almost the same, although slightly higher, than that of Britain and Japan.
Is that overall crime rate or murder rate?
Well, because I'm not quite certain about that. I can't remember if it was murder or crime.
That may be true. On the other hand, it doesn't seem to me exactly says anything. That is to say that if at the bottom of your society is a group of people who statistically are more one race or one class than another, and they commit a lot of crimes, and many of them are black or Hispanic, what you're saying is it's just another way of saying that the society is organized in a way that it has an underclass of people who commit crimes. So I mean, if they weren't black and Puerto Rican, they'd be something else. What I mean is that it's the sort of statistic that, apart from saying the old kind of why don't you all go back to Africa or something like that, in fact, those are Americans, and those are Americans whose crimes you can, I mean, obviously argue any number of sociological theories about why they commit the crimes.
They do have a higher crime rate. In fact, the prisons are populated predominantly, at least in the north and the east, well, almost everywhere. I've seen 85-95% black and Hispanic. I mean, I don't mean to make it,
right.
I'm not making a racial characterization as such. It's simply a statistical one, and that just happens to be a fact of life. If this segment of the population were not there, then the prison population would drop by as much as 95%.
Well, it would be unless there were other people on the bottom. I mean, that is to say, if, in fact, there were no black people in this country and no Hispanics in this country, and the society were organized exactly the way it is now except for that, I assume that you would be able to get some statistic saying, if there are no poor whites in this country, we wouldn't have any crime, or we would have very little, because 90% of the prisons are made up of poor whites, and the other 10% are guys who just embezzled a little and really shouldn't be there in the first place. So what I'm saying is that if they weren't there, somebody else would be there.
In fact, what might happen, were the ethnic minorities to be completely eliminated in terms of crime, or even just say, this, you mentioned back to Africa, just gone, then there might still be a greater number of whites in the prison population, because the law enforcement agencies would be more geared up to ferret them down, to ferret them out, whereas many of the white-collar crimes are probably dismissed, or minor crimes among whites are probably, they just don't prosecute them to the degree that they might a violent ethnic criminal walking through the streets.
Well, I mean, what I'm saying is that the other way of saying that is that you have a population which, by some statistic that the UN or somebody keeps, or somebody somewhere that I read once, has a greater disparity between wealthy and poor than more every all societies but one or two in by some measurement they can take. So in a way, what the other way of putting that statistic is that therefore it seems likely that the have-nots are going to commit crimes, particularly, I mean, if you put that together with certain unemployment statistics or whatever other statistics you have, and then most of the have-nots, or a large percentage of them, are blacks and Puerto Ricans or Hispanics of some sort or some other minority group. I mean, I don't doubt his statistics. All I'm saying is that I'm not sure it would make any difference if you wouldn't eliminate crime by sending everybody back to where he came from. I mean, it would.
Well, let me ask you. You've just returned from a trip out to the West Coast, and I assume that although you didn't promote the book as such, I assume that you touched upon it in some form or another. Did people ask you if you, when you came back home, that you were, if you shook in your boots as soon as you got to the New York City limits for fear of crime?
Oh, I think there is a definite impression in the country that New York is a terrifying place, even though statistically there are any number of crimes that are more likely to take place statistically. I mean, per 1,000 or whatever you want to call it. I don't know how they do the statistics in, say, Detroit or Houston or Los Angeles than there are than New York. I mean, not every crime, but I think New York, the last statistics I read were, murder, it was 6th or 10th or something like that, not first. And I think maybe it's very high on burglary, but rape, it was 9th or 12th, whatever it is. But sure, the impression people have is that it's dangerous. On the other hand, they all seem to come here. So I don't know, but maybe they're simply braver than we've given them credit for.
They come on tour buses, so there are 50 of them in a group.
That's true.
Well,
also, part of that, I have to say, plays in a little bit into the feeling of people in the rest of the country that New York somehow takes upon itself a kind of a superior air, and anything you can say that puts New York down to a certain extent is to the good. So I think a lot of that goes into that. And if you could show that, say, Detroit, I don't mean to single out Detroit, but or Cleveland.
Go ahead.
Single out Detroit. Let's single out Detroit. If you could show statistically that there was twice as much crime of every conceivable type, except embezzlement. I don't think anybody would ever best us in embezzlement because we have all those guys on Wall Street, or fraud, that kind of thing. But every sort of violent crime, that Detroit was three or four times as dangerous as New York. You wouldn't have Detroit jokes on talk shows and things. I mean, as much, because it's part of the feeling of getting at New York a little bit.
You live in Manhattan. Are you nervous?
No, I'm
how many locks do you have on your door?
I think I have an ordinary number of locks.
Three, four, five.
No, not that many. I live in the Village, which I think of as a relatively safe place to live. I would not go on the subway at 3 a.m. through the South Bronx or anything like that, or walk in Central Park at 2 a.m. or something like that. But otherwise I've never thought much about it, no. But certainly in Kansas City, where I come from, where people have as many locks as I do, and where people have been robbed a lot, certainly if you talk about New York, they'll say, isn't it dangerous?
Well, my mother and father live in a rather exclusive suburb of Houston, or actually in, I guess there are no suburbs of Houston.
Right.
Houston owns them all. But they live in a nice subdevelopment. And down the street, a house was burgled. And when the neighbors came home and saw, of course, they phoned the police within minutes. There was a police helicopter over the house. I don't know how many squad cars with dogs. They just didn't take any chances out there. And Houston's not even supposed to have a very large or even a very effective or good police force. It's amazing that they went into action like that. We don't pay much attention to burglaries here in New York.
Well, that's true. I would say that, on the other hand, I think if you look at it to find out which was the most dangerous place or where the burglary rate was. It's very high all over. I mean, and I started traveling around the country for this series in 1967, and as early as that, there were signs in towns in Idaho on filling stations saying this station keeps no cash after 10 o'clock or something like that. If you live in a place in America and you don't bother to lock the doors, it is very likely that you don't have a television set anymore, or maybe even a refrigerator. In fact, it's pervasive crime in America.
What's the matter with Americans? Why do we have this? I know other nations look upon us with disgust, and they admire us in many respects. And they import our culture. Britons watch American television fare constantly. But they also look upon us with fear and disgust because of our rate of violence. Why is this?
They watch the police shows, you mean? The British watch the American police shows.
Well, we have these horrible mass murders. The story in the Times the other day about these drifters who killed, perhaps have killed 200 people over long periods of time. And the massacre of children in Atlanta and migrant workers in California. The Manson killings. The Texas, Austin, Texas sniper. Why do we have this in this country?
Well, I suspect one of the reasons is... compared to, say, a place like England, is that England has a much more homogeneous society. England has basically full employment as a policy, for instance. And I don't mean to say that somebody killing 40 people has anything to do with employment, or very much to do with it. And it's a ragged country. It's always been that way. I mean, it was never as peaceful here as it was in England. And and I suspect that's true of, although on the other hand, it isn't as peaceful here as it is in Canada, which has many things in common. I have to say that a lot of it has to do with guns. And Canada, for instance, doesn't have guns the way we have.
Are you an advocate of gun control or no guns at all?
Well, I'm not an advocate of not allowing people to have their hunting rifles. I have trouble understanding what possible use something like the Saturday Night Special is, other than killing people. Usually, killing somebody that the person knows and doesn't even intend to kill, or even somebody who he doesn't know in a bar and does intend to kill. I don't know if I'm an advocate in the sense that I haven't been on any picket lines lately or written it, but if you say, would you think it would be a good idea to have some control over handguns in this country, particularly, certainly.
Nationwide control, because local controls that don't work.
But local controls obviously just mean that you go to the edge of the state and buy the gun or something like that. Most of the people in this book, I don't think would be alive today if we had gun control. A lot of them in the first place didn't die by guns. Certainly the filmmaker, the first story is about a filmmaker shot in eastern Kentucky. That old man, I don't know what he would have done, kicked him in the shins or something if he didn't have a gun. I mean, the man would be alive. There's a feud of two Mexican American families in California. I think they would find a way to hurt each other pretty badly without guns, but they may not have quite gotten the score up to where they've gotten to with guns.
I was sitting in my car. I was backing into a parking space, while a man was pulling out of a space behind, and he began honking at me, and honking. So, I gave him the finger.
You were in the right, right?
Well, it was just neither of us was right, right. Neither of us was wrong. Just minor. I was backing in. He was pulling out. We came close.
I'm sorry. It wasn't an argument over the spot. It was an argument
It was not an argument over the spot. It was.
Now that's murder stuff. Arguments over spots.
Right. But he was honking. He was honking. So I gave him the finger. He starts to pull up. He jams on his brake. He gets out of his backs up. Gets out of his car. He's a rather big guy, but he's middle aged. Me older than I.
Right.
And he comes storming over and begins to pound on my window, screaming. Well, naturally, I was frightened. I don't know. I realized that this was just a minor exchange of fingers and horns and things like that. I mean, it was nothing, absolutely nothing. One, he didn't know who I was. I mean, I could have had a gun there, and I could have pulled it out and shot him.
Right.
I could have been bigger than he. I could have gotten out, out of the car and hit him with a tire iron. He may have been so angry, and he was a white middle-class, middle-aged man, it looked like to me. He might have killed me. His wife was with him in his car,
right.
Woman. And I just wonder what prompted this strange outburst. Now, I realize that people in cars do this in Texas, right. On the freeways, apparently, if you're cut off, some of these people, because they carry guns down there all the time, right. They shoot you through the windshield.
Right.
They understand that happens a lot. It happens here, too.
Well, there's an irritation at, obviously, people get driven to the end of their tether by some of the irritations of the city. I think another aspect of the city, not just New York, but any large city, is anonymity. That is, if that had happened in a little town, the man really couldn't count on never seeing you again. It's a big control over your anger if you know you're going to have to pass the guy again tomorrow, and that you're probably going to see him at the Kiwanis on Wednesday. In my experience traveling around the country is that even though a lot of these murders take place in small towns, the level of anger, or at least of the display of anger, is a function partly of the size of the place. Not simply that it's more irritating, but that it's anonymous. The people, when people say that people in, say, a Midwestern small town get along, doesn't mean that they're all saintly. It means that, in fact, it's somewhat embarrassing to pound on the guy's window and kick his car, call him all sorts of horrible names, and then see him the next day at coffee where the businessmen gather at the cafe. Even a town the size of Kansas City, where I come from, I would be likely to see the people I went to high school with fairly regularly. I've just run into them on the street, because if you narrow the number of places to park your car downtown, the number of restaurants to go to, or something like that, you're just likely to run into people more, and I think it puts a check on the level of the viciousness of the exchange. That check is removed in the city when you ask the cab driver for the change in a quarter, and he calls you a fascist, or starts attacking you, or maybe pulls out his gun finally. That has to do, I think, a lot with being in a city. He doesn't, not only doesn't know you, but he isn't likely ever to see you again. You're just a face.
It's a very good thought. We've been talking for about half an hour, Calvin Trillin, and I wonder if there's any other points that we might cover before we sign off.
Not if you, as long as you're unarmed, I think. I think that would be,
Do you have a gun?
No, I don't.
I would like to see, I worry about guns. I would like to see, obviously, the Saturday night, I'd like to see handguns banned, and except for police officers. But even police officers, I would not like to see carry guns when they are not on duty. Recently, the former police commissioner issued an executive order in which he now the police department, when they're off duty and going to a party or a place where they drink, they do not have to carry their weapons. Theoretically, police officers are supposed to remain armed 24 hours.
Right.
But you know that there have been so many instances of violence involving off-duty police officers who shoot fellow officers, who shoot their wives, who commit suicide.
Right.
And it would seem to me that would be a small area. We could cut down the number of deaths from gun abuse by requiring police officers to check out their guns when they report to duty each day and check them back in with the bullets.
Yeah, I would. Well, if you just think of suicide, I mean, as you know, the suicide rate is high among police officers, and partly this is a stressful job, and there are all kinds of worries, but also simple availability. I mean, when you think about the ways of killing yourself, most of them are very unpleasant. Aside from the fact you're going to be dead, and certainly holding a police revolver to your head and pulling the trigger is about the cleanest, neatest way. And if you had to stop to consider otherwise, you might not do it. It's quite true.
I don't know. What's it feel like having a bullet go through your head? That doesn't occur. I don't fancy that idea at all.
Oh, is that right? Well, would you rather jump off the Empire State Building?
I don't want to do any of it right now.
Would you rather throw yourself in front of a subway car?
Well, I wonder about suicide. I often wondered about the desperation that people must have that prompt them to do something like that. They must be extremely...
Well, except they're still thinking. I once was at one of those hotels that has the very high atrium lobby.
Yeah.
And I asked, the public relations person came around, it was during a mayor's convention or something, and said hello, and then to make conversation, I said, have you had any problem with suicides? People jumping into the lobby. And, you know, the Atlanta hotel, the higher Regency, that first one like that, they've had a lot of suicides in the lobby. And she said, no, one of the things we did is that we asked some psychologists, and jumpers like a clear shot at the ground. I don't know who you interview to get these statistics, by the way. I don't know, but it must be a very quick interview. And so they built out the first floor so that you wouldn't get a clear shot at the ground. Well, I say, well, there's a clear shot over there by the coffee shop. And she said, yeah, and you wouldn't find me eating there either. But yeah. So apparently people who are about to jump really think about such things.
We had a suicide here in the building. It struck me as very odd. We had a middle management type who jumped in the, I guess it was sort of it's a shaft, an air shaft or something,
right,
inside the building. And several people knew him, and he fell 20 flights down and was killed. Well, normally, suicides don't get too much reporting. If somebody jumped, some middle executive in Mobil Oil jumped, or JCPenney jumped, but this thing made the wire services. And even my family read it in the Houston Post. And I just wonder why there had been so much publicity, simply because it's a CBS employee, and not even an important one, who was obviously despondent, upset for something, I don't know why, and committed suicide, and yet this thing went national.
Well, that's
strange.
Well, it is strange, but it is also true that people who commit suicide often assume that it's going to make a kind of a either a newspaper or something, and you can see that there are certain places that draw people for suicides. The most famous, obviously, is the Golden Gate Bridge. One of the problems in Atlanta, I think, is they didn't have a proper place to commit suicide until they put the hotel up, and even then people started to jump outside the hotel. They didn't catch on right away. Then they finally figured, the way to go with a tremendous flourish is to go inside.
Well, you know, they're putting up another one of these atrium hotels here in New York, so we have to watch our steps.
Wear a hard hat in the lobby, don't.
Listen, this is not really funny. And when are we going to expect something amusing from you in terms of the
Well, I don't know. A little while. I think we're going to have to be in depression for a little while.
Another novel?
I may do another novel, although I don't really have anything particular in mind. I suppose I might do another collection of the Nation columns, follow-up to On Civil Liberties, which I've done about as many now as I had then. So maybe that will be a little lighter fare next time.
Well, listen, in spite of the theme, I enjoyed having you in and talking to you, and have you back next collection.
Okay. Thanks very much.